You're listening to Road to GEM, a podcast by Harvard Center for International Development. I'm Eri Peña, a student at the Harvard Kennedy School, and your host for today's episode. In this season, we're delving deep into the intersection of gender and international development. And today, as part of our special series on zooming into the LGBTQ plus movement worldwide, we're shining a spotlight onto incredible activists and social entrepreneurs, one from Lebanon and another from Mexico. Let's dive in. Joining us first is Tarek Sidan, the executive director at Helem, the first LGBTQ plus organization in the Arab world. Welcome, Tarek.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to talk to you.
Yeah, same here. I'm thrilled to have you here. And I'm actually wondering if we could start out with why you founded this organization. What inspired you to do it?
Well, the organization is a grassroots response, grassroots organized response to what was then and continues to be incredibly escalated levels of violence and targeting against the LGBTQ community. So no one really founded Helem on their own. It was the community that got together. It was sort of the early days of the internet back in 2000 when the early days of, you know, chat groups and sort of social media. And there were already lots of folks that, because of the internet, had started to find one another. And the community started to build across, you know, different geographic locations within the country. And a small group of that community decided to get political, decided enough was enough. And there needed to be some sort of organized, mobilized response against all of the police brutality that we were witnessing at the time. And so that's what really prompted around 30 individuals to come together for that first meeting. I mean, at the time, I was 18 years old, so I was obviously on the much younger side of things. And decided to come together and say, what does a political LGBT group look like in the Arab world? And what is it that we should be doing and prioritizing? And that's how it was created. At first, it was sort of this loose collective, and then it suddenly became an organization that did a lot of programming and organizing more formally.
Well, congratulations. That's a lot of years fighting and leading a successful organization. And I guess that's my next question. How has the movement and fighting for the rights of this population changed in those 24 years?
Well, it's quite unrecognizable because, like many other parts of the world, the movement in itself sort of ebbs and flows and takes on different forms. I would safely say that at least in the first 15 years of Helem's inception, the movement was perceived to be very much connected to the different organizations, whether it was Helem or organizations that was started by Helem alumni through sort of nonprofits. But that wouldn't be really accurate because the movement itself had begun more formally back in the days of the Civil War in the 1970s in Lebanon. And it's that precise sort of aspect and component of not just the LGBTQ movement, but all sort of identity-based and social justice movements that remains obscured because of these collectives and groups that decided to do something very local at the time and did not have the audience that social media allows, did not have the coverage that traditional media would have otherwise done due to the fact of the cause being fundamentally unpopular. And what good cause isn't unpopular, at least in the beginning. It began as sort of small groups and collectives, people that were helping each other out with the resources that they had when they had them. And then it became a little bit more formal with these organizations sort of coming together, Helem being the first, and a lot of NGOization of the movement occurred, which is both a good and a bad thing. You know, you do need organizations. They play a pivotal role, but they cannot be the only vehicle through which you deploy and you disseminate or you sort of organize people and power and resources. And so much, the good news is that more recently, the number and the diversity of actors that are pushing LGBTQ equality, or I should say more so like queer liberation, have become much more diversified. It's not just organizations anymore. It's artists that are very visible and very brave. It's young people that are organizing on their campuses or that are producing quintessentially queer Arab cultural content. It's now allies have become a lot more vocal, a lot more visible, and a lot more brave. And I don't just mean traditional allies in international circles or in sort of very, very liberal circles. I'm talking about, politicians that have started to become openly pro-LGBTQ rights, or journalists, or other sort of issue-based as opposed to identity-based movements, like the labor rights movement. So syndicates and unions have started to speak up a lot more, as well as other identity-based movements that have over the years been exposed enough and engaged with enough in order to recognize LGBTQ people as a natural extension of all of the different groups that are working for a particular right or a particular reform. The disability rights movement, the feminist movement, the refugee rights and migrant workers' rights movements in Lebanon are but a few examples of that. And that was largely due to a lot of the work that organizations as well as individuals had been doing in order to build power horizontally with other groups, as opposed to just oppose power vertically in government or in the religious establishment, etc. You obviously have always had allies in the medical field. You've always had allies in academia, and more and more allies started forming in the judiciary and people working with the law. So it's very much sort of or at least the attempt is to be as ubiquitous as possible and to engage with as large an array of allies as possible. And so now the movement looks more like a movement, even though it's dysfunctional and not necessarily very strategic, and there isn't necessarily a lot of cohesion between these actors, because you don't have a perfectly overlapping Venn diagram of values or of strategies or of priorities. But nevertheless, there is a lot there to work with now that was never the case in the first decade and a half, or even, I would say even 2 decades of Hilm's existence, when we were really, really on our own.
That's really fascinating. And I think that any social movement, especially those that are alive and vibrant and well, contain contradictions and different perspectives. And I actually think that's an indicator of richness and diversity. So taking into account that evolution that you're describing, what do you see as the biggest opportunities for the LGBTQ plus movement in Lebanon and in the broader Middle East?
Well, contrary to sort of the news and contrary to what we're witnessing happening at the moment, and I should say, the past 3 or 4 years have been quite devastating for the MENA region as a whole, not just in terms of security and in terms of war and violence, but also in terms of economic recessions and stagnations, in terms of massive geopolitical shifts in the region and sort of the ascension of local and sort of regional powers, such as the countries in the Gulf Cooperation Council, which tend to be incredibly both socially and religiously conservative. Lebanon itself has had its fair share of tragedy with with the explosion that took place in 2020, which was only 400 meters away from our center in Beirut, which completely devastated our work and really injured so many of the people that were there and that and our colleagues. In addition to sort of the particular regional translations and manifestations of the global anti-gender movement that really sort of, along with existing endemic and chronic homophobia and transphobia, really coalesced into some of the most harmful and alarming developments in the past few years in terms of violence against the community. Iraq, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. I'm just talking about the Levant and Egypt, but I mean, it's really across the board. And in Lebanon, where we had witnessed such progress, the progress was halted. It was not reversed because of the amount of work we had put in to create allies and to sort of solidify the position, but it really has been taking a beating continuously since really around the time of the World Cup, which was one of the major catalysts for what's going on. But despite all of this sort of gloom and doom, I personally, as a sort of a student of social movements and particularly comparative liberation, queer liberation movements around the world and in the global South, this is a positive sign. It's a positive sign that the issue has graduated in a way from a tangential social issue to a very much sort of a central political concern. Right now in Lebanese elections, where you stand on LGBTQ rights is one of the pivotal questions that many candidates or many people running for parliament would have to answer. And so even though the existing regimes and existing political powers and religious powers sought to capitalize in the short term on this manufactured moral public panics around gender and sexuality by painting queer people as deviants, as threats to the nuclear family, threats to children, and most acutely as sort of agents of foreign Western imperial cultural imperialism. The fact that they tried to capitalize on this in the short term so greedily and so quickly did cause a lot of harm and is continuing to cause a lot of harm, it also inadvertently made LGBTQ rights a major issue. And you know that thing about when you say, don't think of an elephant, and the first thing you do is think of an elephant. So the elephant in the room, suddenly became visible. It suddenly became not this issue that you whisper about and that, you know, that is not something to be discussed in polite company, or that you you try to eradicate or completely erase queer people from media, from public discourse in order to pretend like they don't exist. Now that is no longer possible. And the fact that they try to use it means that it will definitely, the fight has begun and that they are a very powerful foe. But that also means that there's no putting the genie back in the bottle, so to speak. And that also means that now that there is, you know, people that are as powerful as the Secretary General of Hezbollah, as the Greek Orthodox Patriarch and the Grand Mufti of the Lebanese Republic, coming up and speaking about you and sort of really elevating the issue by hyperbolizing just how dangerous and how much of a threat they paint the community to be in order to, you know, distract from all of the other political and economic disasters and scandals in the country. Inadvertently, that gives you a lot of power, because then you become, you are able to then leverage that platform you are then able to retort and respond to people of that caliber in the very same vehicles which they chose to dispense their hate. In this case, major media outlets and all over social media. So it, paradoxically, even though it seems that things have never been more dire, it's actually never been more promising. It's going to hurt, and a lot of people are going to be harmed. And I don't say this because anybody being harmed is at all acceptable in any way. But history also shows us that all of social movements have had people that, you know, it was built on the shoulders of people that sacrificed so much of their health and their time and their resources and their happiness and sometimes their lives. And to be honest with you, queer people in the MENA region have been dying for centuries, for decades. And it's not just they've been dying because they've been attacked for their identity or for their sexuality. They've been dying in wars. They've been dying. Queer people are dying in Palestine as we speak right now. It's not like it's something new. It's that now it is also part the question of queer liberation, of rights, of what will it take to share the space between queer and non-queer people outside of, you know, the familiar social and cultural context of the global North and the West. These things are right now beginning to be negotiated, and the tug of war has begun. So it's really a very pivotal time, and a time where we need to be really very careful as to how we deploy ourselves, what kind of messaging we put out there, and who exactly we would want on our side to make this movement successful.
Absolutely. And I think it's absolutely critical to recognize the strides made by the LGBTQ plus movement. And you're right, queer liberation is not a new thing, but the fact that LGBTQ plus rights are now on the agenda is a huge step forward. And I really do believe that that progress is a testament to the efforts of activists like yourself, as well as those alliances that you were talking about with government, media, and other movements. I really believe that the only way forward is together, right? So thank you so much for joining us, and especially thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now we're moving on to another country across the world with an equally vibrant LGBTQ plus movement, Mexico. But this vibrancy is on par with its complexity. Laws may look strong and avant-garde, mostly, but what do those laws mean when met with a lack of enforcement and oversight? We are here with Enrique Torremolina, an LGBTQ activist from Mexico, to discuss that and other questions. Welcome, Enrique.
Hi, Evie. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And I think we could just step right into it. Tell us a little bit about the most significant challenges faced by the LGBTQ community in Mexico.
So I think two challenges for the LGBTQ plus community in Mexico are violence and impunity, which, you know, there are those are challenges faced by the Mexican population more broadly, but that obviously have particular impacts on different groups of people, just like they impact women differently, for example. There's also the challenge of improving LGBT people's mental health, and I would say particularly LGBT youth. Society has evolved so much in terms of inclusion and acceptance, and our community has achieved so much in terms of laws and visibility. And yet the numbers for LGBT youth mental health are pretty bad. Only 30% of LGBT youth feel accepted when they come out to their families. 14% of LGBT youth in Mexico have left home or have been kicked out of home by their parents. These are numbers just from last month, by the way, that the organization, the Trevor Project, just put out a few weeks ago. And also most of LGBT youth with depression or suicide risk don't have access to mental health services because of a lack of resources or because of fear that a mental health professional will try to, quote unquote, cure them from being LGBT. And finally, there's the almost never-ending risk of having certain rights taken away. And we've seen examples of this all around the world. The risk of society and culture and institutions moving backwards. I don't think that will happen, or I don't think it will happen easily, in Mexico with LGBT rights, but the challenge is to remind ourselves that we did not get to this point magically. It's been hard work, and we have to keep up that work.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. So yes, I mean, I think the stigma, the backlash of rights, the impunity, some of these challenges exist, like you said, for the broader Mexican population, but are really heightened just by virtue of existing as mm-hmm. part of the LGBTQ plus community, mm-hmm. right? And I'm really curious, because I know your organization is doing great work. What are you doing to address some of these challenges that you just outlined?
So my organization is called Colmena 41. A translation would be Hive or Beehive 41. Our purpose is to connect, to inspire, and to also study the LGBT community in Mexico and our allies. And we have three main lines of work. One is a series of monthly in-person events in Mexico City where we have different speakers talk about different subjects. And we have a space for networking and for people to connect with others from different industries and professional backgrounds. Another line of work is a program that fosters LGBT entrepreneurship. You know, we have workshops, mentorship. We publicize stories of LGBT entrepreneurs all over Mexico because we have identified that starting a business, starting a project, starting an organization for LGBT people is a very important source of pride and, you know, of just being improving their mental health and improving the way they feel about themselves. And finally, we have a research program that produced the first study on LGBT entrepreneurship in Latin America. It was a study on LGBT entrepreneurship in Mexico, and now it's being replicated in by other organizations in Argentina, Chile, and Brazil. And Colmena 41 is pretty young. We're only 5 years old. It's a younger organization. It's a small organization. So we're very proud of our achievements so far. And it's an interesting story. My co-founding partner, Federico, came from the social entrepreneurship world. He's an economist, while my background was LGBT advocacy. So before Colmena, for over 10, 12 years, I had been doing research and campaigns and fundraising and communications for human rights organizations. I was doing consulting and training on diversity and inclusion for companies and media in different countries. And both of us working in these different fields became aware of the increasing interest that people and organizations everywhere had in supporting the LGBTQ plus community, of becoming active in the fight for equality and inclusion. So we decided to create a platform that would help bring all of those efforts together.
Yeah, it sounds like there is a lot to be proud of, a lot of things that you're doing, really exciting. And it also sounds like you're at the intersection of advocacy and business, which I think is really interesting and exciting right now.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more about any main takeaways that came out of this research study that you mentioned before about social entrepreneurship for the community?
Sure. So there's a few. A couple that I find the most interesting and that were pretty revealing to me personally is how, you know, we often think of kind of the profile of someone who's an entrepreneur as someone who has always dreamt of having their own business and starting their own project. And what we found is that that is the case, for example, for some gay men, bisexual men. But it's very different for transgender women, for example, where most of the stories of trans women who eventually decide to become their own bosses, to start their own businesses, that happens after they faced just so many experiences of work discrimination that they, you know, they come to a point of saying, you know, my only option or my best option is if I generate, you know, work for myself and not depend on others to hire me. And another one is that, you know, even in like the most conventional fields of business, like, for example, things like, I'm forgetting the word in English, insurance, LGBT people who start like their insurance companies or insurance agencies, they always, you know, just because, you know, of their own lived experience, they find small ways where they can like tweak or improve or innovate in those fields in ways that you know, that business will become more accommodating or more inclusive of LGBT people. So if you, you know, taking that into a bigger picture, LGBT entrepreneurs are actually contributing to innovation and creativity and improving the different fields where they are starting their businesses.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, innovation comes from need. And it's so awesome to hear about the way that this community is leveraging. You talked a little bit about working kind of cross-sector, right? Like, you come from the advocacy world, your partner comes from more the social entrepreneurship world. I'm curious to hear, what do you think are the most important alliances to build right now in order for the LGBTQ movement to advance its priorities?
Right. It's a great... I'm very happy you bring that up, because I started working with the business sector, with companies, about 10 years ago, you know, when the conversation around the business case for inclusion, not just LGBT inclusion, but inclusion more generally in Mexico, started taking more strength. You know, it was at a point where some companies already had LGBT inclusion policies in place at their organizations in Mexico, but they were afraid that the rest of the world up beyond the walls of that company would know, because they thought that would hurt them commercially, or you know, people who were buying their products or their services would be like, I don't agree with these values, I don't want this company, you know, my bank or my telephone provider or whatever, to be in favor of LGBT people. And in a relatively short amount of time, you know, less than 15 years, that shift, you know, these companies have shifted to a point where now they're desperate for the world to know that they have this values. And that has, you know, it started in the case of Mexico, this started the first wave of companies that would do this were big international companies that have a presence in Mexico. But then, you know, the big Mexican companies have followed after them. And, you know, many of the, like, the biggest and the most important businesses in Mexico are family companies or family owned. And they, you know, they have a very traditional history in terms of, you know, how they make business, what their values are, the way they advertise what they sell. And it's been fascinating to see how those companies have changed, just because, you know, they want to be players on the same level as their international competitors. And one of the effects that I think that is having is that now, you know, we see another wave of companies that are small, medium-sized businesses that are understanding that diversity, inclusion makes sense for their business, because they see the biggest players in their sector, you know, the companies that they look up to, that are, you know, walking down that path. So I think what companies are doing, what business is doing by supporting LGBT inclusion is having a cultural effect. The reason why so many of these big brands feel comfortable saying we support LGBT rights, we support projects like Colmena 41, we want to be present in LGBT pride marches, with all of the criticism that, you know, that includes, is having an effect on the way people in general think about LGBT rights and about LGBT people.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think it's so true, the tradition of family businesses in Mexico and the quote-unquote values that they convey and the reason, the way why they became so powerful. I think it goes back to something that I was talking about with an organizer from Brazil, which I think is true across Latin America, how there's this huge gap between, you know, having really progressive laws when it comes to protecting LGBTQ people and other minorities, but then reality is a little bit different, right? We have, I think you're talking about this a little bit, but what gives you hope in this moment?
The amount of people who are curious to learn about the LGBT community's challenges and needs, the amount of people and organizations and companies who want to be better allies to LGBT equality. I literally see that every day through my work and through Colmena 41's work, and that gave me a lot of hope. Just yesterday, I was invited to teach a class on LGBT representation in media for a group of students who are already working in the film and television industry in Latin America. And just seeing how curious they were about, you know, taking care of the LGBT storylines that they're crafting and the LGBT characters that they're writing, and how, you know, they want to pay attention to like very small details to not use their work or to use their work in a positive way and not use it to legitimize hatred or discrimination. You know, things like that give me a lot of hope, and I see more of that increasingly.
Even the way you're describing it is really interesting, because, you know, I think in a different world we'd be hearing about, even, and this would even be rare, talking about it 20 years ago, but people being scared of the way that their work is being used by others. Mm-hmm. But the ownership of thinking about making sure that they're not kind of advancing the wrong harmful narratives, I think that's mm-hmm. quite a shift, and that's really interesting.
Yes, exactly. They've, you know, people are becoming aware, especially people who are not LGBT, but who want to support the LGBT equality cause, they are becoming more and more aware of their responsibility. And as you said, they are taking ownership in, like, you know, the role as people who support this movement. And that's very exciting. And that's, as you said, that's definitely a shift. I mean, I became active in LGBT issues when I was in my second year of university. So this was like 18 years ago, 17 years ago. And things have changed so visibly and so quickly. And again, just going back to something I said before, that also means that, you know, it's important that we don't take so many things for granted. But I think it's nice to see this and feel hopeful and feel excited. And trust that, you know, it will only continue this way if we get more and more people to support the LGBT community.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And I think it is critical. You talk about business, you talk about advocacy, social entrepreneurship, there's education, communication, narrative. I think that working across sectors and fields is absolutely critical, and the only way forward is together, right? Thank you so much, Enrique, for being with us.
Of course.
And to wrap up our mini-series on the LGBTQ+ movement within the Road to GEM podcast, we'll hear once more from our esteemed guests. We asked each of them to imagine a world where gender takes the center stage in international development. What would that future look like? Here's what Enrique, Tarek, Professor McCarthy, Diego, Enosa, and Antonia had to say.
And, you know, I think if we really aim for a future where gender takes center stage in international development, that has to include LGBT people and LGBT struggles, because there are, that perspective just makes sense to me.
Instead of creating 300 and 400 and counting groups and sort of compartments of people, you know, check this person has a disability, check this person is this sexual orientation, check this person is this gender identity, check this person has these particular set of sexual characteristics. It's this sort of division. I think it at some point we need to understand that gender really means everyone. Including, and forgive me for saying this, including cisgender men that do have particular development needs. Men do have development. I don't mean physical development. I mean international development needs. I'm not saying we should prioritize them right now by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm saying that I really look forward to a time where these sort of identity markers are not the only prism through which we view these issues. In international development, peace building, all of these sort of global issues that we're facing. And it might be really altruistic and it might not be very achievable right now, but I'm personally, and we at Hilm are very, very sort of wary of how powerful and dangerous identity can be. And so we, when we deploy it very, very judiciously in order lest it overwhelm us.
You know, I think our notions of gender are changing, Evie, as you well know, right? That I think in the past, insofar as international development and this kind of human rights, you know, communities have thought about gender, it has often been assumed that gender means women and girls, right? And so that a lot of our UN, you know, work and a lot of the global work in terms of gender rights has been focused on that, and justly so, right? And thankfully so. But I do think that we're in a situation where we have to think more expansively about gender when it comes to international development, human rights, or anything related to those things, right? That this is something that we understand there are many genders, right? Just as there are many sexualities and many different types of people in the world, right? Thinking about a gender in a more expansive way does not mean that we shift the focus away from the rights that still need to be achieved and the livelihoods that still need to be protected and amplified and elevated for women and girls. It means that we also have to think about how transgender people, how non-binary people, how folks who are intersex, people who are not comfortably sitting within or existing within the very limited way that we have, I think, historically thought about, many people have thought about gender, certainly the big institutions and governments and so forth have thought about gender, but thinking gender expansively, right, in a way that would accommodate, right, and include all of those different kinds of peoples, and then centering them, right, at the center of not just a rights, you know, project, but of a freedom project and of an equality and equity project and of a liberation project, ultimately. And that requires, you know, a redistribution of power within political institutions. It requires us to, I think, really rethink how we think about people and how we think about the ordering of people and the categorization of people and the positioning of people. And it also, I think, with that more expansive idea about gender, right, and various lived experiences comes a whole, I think, reimagining about families and children and education and healthcare and reproductive liberation and justice and all sorts of things when it comes to things. So I think a reframing and a reimagining of a more expanded gender universe then will lead us to hopefully opening up the possibility of reimagining all of it, right? Which is at the heart of liberation.
Yeah, I'm really thankful that you included this conversation on this talk about international development. You know, I mean, obviously there are places in the world where women and girls need to be the priority because of the situation, to mention this, you know, still the amount of child marriages we have, etc. But I hope that the movements and the people leading them don't think that that's the end point, right? Just when women and girls are liberated, that means that we've hit the gender, the conversation gender ends. Because the truth is that we have a wide diversity of human expressions of gender. It challenges so many of the things that we were taught. And it is often a learning that comes with a lot of loss for people. And so we need to manage those losses effectively when we talk about it. So I do think that that is part of the conversation of international development. Think about how to manage the loss of an evolving way of looking at things, but then also bring people along to understand that once those challenges are met with the way the women and girls are being discriminated against and in many ways just the violence against them, that is not the end of the conversation, but just the next step into thinking of what's next in the beautiful diversity of gender that we have in the world and humanity.
I'm envisioning a society with reduced gender-based violence. I'm seeing a society where there's a lot of peace. I'm seeing a society with very quality products within the agriculture sector, within the business sector. within, you know, within the organizing sector, we are seeing a lot of products in that particular context. We are seeing a society where different opportunities, you know, different abilities, different talents are taken carefully, are taken seriously, you know, are giving birth, you know, to products that are needed in the society at the moment. So for me, having a future where gender is in the center of development, then I'm envisioning a society of a lot of peace, harmony, of love. I'm seeing a lot of togetherness, you know, and that would be, I can't even wait to see a future of that particular context. And that would be incredible for me as a minority today, and seeing myself as a part of and being heard, being a voice of concern, being a voice to give attention. And that is very important to me.
A future where gender takes center stage international development, for me, looks like a future that is, of course, more inclusive, that respect our different identities, our different needs, that understand that the impact of each policy, each new rule impact people differently, and it must be studied, documented, that different voices need to be not only heard, but also participating actively in the process, and where we understand also that gender is not only two, that is a social construction and goes beyond of this discussion of biological versus social, because what matters is that we need to feel okay in our bodies, and we need to feel on control of our destiny. And centering gender international development can truly create a world where we centralize those who are on the margin. And centralizing those who are on the margin, we might think very different from what we have thinking so far. Even the development concept, what is development and for what and for who we are developing, you know?
That wraps up today's episode, but our journey is far from over. Be sure to tune in to the upcoming episodes of Road to GEM 2024.